ask a question by way of opening. Just raise your hand here if any of you have ever had the chance to go to the Louvre Art Museum in Paris. Just pop your hand up if you've had a chance to. It's that amazing building which has got that kind of pyramid entrance of glass outside the front. It's pretty iconic. So thank you if you've been to that. I want to open this morning by showing you a painting that hangs in the Louvre. And Becca is going to put that up on the screen for us. And I'm going to ask you another question. Which Bible story do you think this painting is showing? Just shout out if you think you know which one. What Bible story do you think this old grandmaster painting is showing? Yeah, is you Emma? Nice and loud. What story in the Bible is it? Don't worry if you haven't got it. Anyone else? Anyone want to hazard a guess? Not the Last Supper. Good guess. And this painter went on to paint a painting of the Last Supper. What? Who shouted out the wedding at Cana? Oh, Toby Araje. Secretly cultured, Toby. I tease you. It is the wedding at Cana. Very, very good. Well done. It is a painting by an Italian grandmaster Renaissance painter called Paolo Veronese. And he painted this between 1562 and 1563. And it is based on the miracle of the water being turned into wine in John chapter 2, verses 1 to 11. Let me just talk you through some of the things that might be good for you to see. So this guy here in the green, this is the master of the feast. This was the person who went to the bridegroom in the parable and said, everybody normally keeps the old horrible wine to the end, but you have brought out the best wine now. And that's him, that's that person. In 1989, when the Louvre decided to restore the painting, there was a massive uproar because as they started to clean through the painting, what they realized was that this green was the original color underneath. And actually, for all that time, ever since the 1560s, it had been red. And the theory is that Veronese maybe repainted it red over the top from the original green because he wanted to say something about wine. We don't know what the full story was there, but of course people had known the painting for many hundreds of years, and this key figure in it was in red cloth. And then, of course, it was discovered to be green cloth. I just want to draw your attention to the fact that what's happening over here... Oh, I should also say that Veronese did the Renaissance art equivalent of a selfie. He is actually... He painted himself just here into the painting. So that's kind of, pretty cheeky, really. But he's done that. He's included himself in the artwork. And apparently he included lots of famous figures of the day. So there he is. So that's a sort of self-portrait of him. What we have over here is we have some of the servants decanting some of the new wine or the best wine from the pitchers into these flagons. And then over on this side, the master of the feast is presenting it to the happy couple who are over here. This is the bride and the groom. And they're just about to, you can see somebody is holding a glass of the new wine here. And down this left-hand side here, you can see lots and lots of people having there's a bit of a buzz going on, a bit of a chat about, oh, okay, this wine is great. There's a lot of interest in it on this left-hand side. What we normally do in weddings here in the UK in 2023 is we put the happy couple in the middle of the top table, don't we? But who do we have in the middle of the top table in this painting? Jesus, absolutely. We have Jesus in the middle. And this is Jesus right here. This is Jesus just there. And Jesus is the only person looking straight out at the viewer of the painting. And what Veronese is trying to say is, hey, Jesus is the most important person you'll ever meet. He's also saying that Jesus is the real bridegroom. So you have obviously a bride and a groom for the human wedding, but Jesus is the real bridegroom. He is central to this painting. And in fact, he's horizontally, absolutely central, right in the middle. And what Veronese is also saying is that Jesus is central in life and central in heaven. Let me also point out one or two other things to you. Above Jesus, what can you see up there? You can see a couple of guys with knives, or a chap with a knife, and he's carving some lamb. And that lamb is meant to represent the fact that Jesus will go to a sacrifice, and that Jesus is the Lamb of the world who is given up as a sacrifice for our sins. And Veronese is very clever, because what he does is he puts that above Jesus, like on top of Jesus, over him. And it's as though what he's saying, you know, do you remember that miracle in John 2 is the very first miracle that Jesus performs? What he's saying is that even in the midst of all this revelry and being the bridegroom and being the centerpiece of heaven, Jesus has something hanging over him, which is a knowledge that he is going to go to his death through a sacrifice on the cross. And that's what the painter is trying to show by showing the lamb being carved above him. When they commissioned the painting, it was a monastery who commissioned the painting, and they commissioned, it was the Order of St. Benedict in Venice, and they ordered the painting from Veronese on the 6th of June, 1652. And in the brief they set him, they set him a couple of things. They said, we want you to include as many people as you can. And I think he's ended up painting over 130 different figures in there. They also asked him to use what was then kind of very fashionable at that time in Renaissance art, which was optimal colours, so that the colours of the painting would be very bright. And what you'll notice in the painting is there are some odd sections which are in blue. The blue was very expensive. It was a colour called ultramarine, and it was made from a semi-precious stone called lapis lazuli. And what they did was they'd grind that stone up into the pigment of the paint to get that really deep blue. But what Veronese has done is he's reserved the most pure and the brightest blue for Jesus's tunic. He's got a sash there, isn't he, that he's wearing like around him, like a robe. And if you look carefully, you'll see there's other bits of blue in the painting, but arguably the brightest, and I think the brightest in real life, if you go and see it, is that blue that Jesus is wearing. And what Veronese is trying to say is, hey, this is the King of Heaven, and he has sovereignty, and he is regal, and he is worthy. This painting that you see, obviously we're lucky here at BCC that we've invested in a big screen. Our screen is 40 square metres. It's 8 metres by 5 metres. This painting is 67.3 square metres. So we're actually seeing a shrunken version of this right now. If you go to the Louvre, you'll get it about a third again as big. That's some going, isn't it? The painting itself, the canvas, I was reading up about this, it weighs 1.5 tons with the frame and all the canvas and all the stuff that goes with it. So if you're ever in the Louvre in Paris, see if you can see The Wedding at Cana by Paolo Veronese. It's their largest painting by a long margin. Very, very impressive piece of artwork. Now, Veronese undertook the commission, and he was paid 324 Venetian gold ducats. And if you look up gold coins these days, Venetian ducats are worth a lot of money. But he was paid 324 of those for this. He was allowed a barrel of wine while he was working, and he ate in the refectory, like the restaurant that was with the monastery. So he had a kind of a good number there, and he was kind of working away. But I want to ask us all a really challenging question this morning. Where in the world is somebody doing a piece of artwork that takes over a year to finish, which is dedicated to the glory of God? Where is that happening right now? Where is it happening? Come and tell me afterwards if you know of any creative artists or sculptors or musicians or anyone in the creative arts at all who is spending more than a year on one piece of artwork for the glory of God. Because I don't think it's happening in our culture anymore. I don't think it's happening. Do you see it? We have 15 seconds on TikTok and we think that's creative. Now, listen, I'm someone that doesn't like to slam another thing because one thing's really good. I actually think some of the content on TikTok's really creative. I really do. But we're in a different time now, aren't we? We really are. This guy worked for 14 months before he delivered it on one single piece of artwork, 130 characters in it. It's a phenomenal piece of art, isn't it? If you look really carefully, there's actually a number of animals in here. There's two dogs down here. There's a dog over there. There's a dog peeping out right at the top through the balcony. I hope he hasn't got his head stuck. He's up there. There's a little chihuahua here, look. You see that? And there's a cat down here, just like lying around by the pitcher of the wine. Veronese got hauled before the Spanish Inquisition a few years later for including animals in the painting that somebody shouted out, The Last Supper. He did another painting, and he had to change the name of the painting because the Spanish Inquisition thought his presentation of animals was too casual. It wasn't reverent enough. He didn't get done by the Spanish Inquisition, but he was told off and sent away with a warning. That's just weird to us, isn't it, now? I'm just staggered by how amazing that art is. I'm not questioning whether it's holy enough. I think it's awesome. I really do. I wanted to open that today because with that. Thank you, Becca. You can take that off the screen now. I wanted to open by showing you that picture because we're in part 5 of our series, which is Big Ideas, Faithful Steps. And today's big idea is creativity. The big idea that we want to look at today is creativity. And what is creativity? And it's ever so tempting to wheel out a great piece of art or a wonderful piece of music or a play or a composition or a sculpture and then say, well, that's creativity. But in truth, creativity is woven into our lives in all sorts of different ways. Any time that we contemplate bringing something into existence that is not there right now, we are engaged in creativity. Creativity brings something into being which was not there before. Now, any time you and I do something that we've never done before, we are being creative. You know, when contestants learn a new routine for Strictly on Saturday night for BBC One, they are being creative and being led into something creative that they need to learn. They will have never done that precisely in that way before. When you apply for a job or I apply for a job that we have never done before, there is an element of that which is a creative step. We are saying, I'm prepared to try something new that I've never done before. Even if you read a book or watch a film for the first time, you're permitting someone else's creativity to interact with your imagination in some great ways. And if you think about it, all of our societies and all of our infrastructure owe their origin in part to creativity. They really do. I don't know if you've had a chance recently to walk up from BCC, kind of up the hill into town. But someone has decided that it would be a great idea to put a brand new 8-sided high-rise residential block at the top of the hill there. You can see that after church if you go into town for lunch. And it's rising up and rising up. I don't know how tall it's going to get, but on the billboards beside it, they are advertising that this is the very first 8-sided high-rise residential block in the world. And what that means is that other residential blocks have gone up, maybe with 7 sides, maybe with 5, maybe with a standard of 4. I don't know. But somebody has decided to do something brand new that has never been done before. Now, there's a bunch of principles in there that still need to apply, like architectural protocols to make the building stand up. Some of that isn't new. But the core concept of an 8-sided high-rise residential block, brand new. Nobody has done that before. And this is how my mind works as a pastor. I'm thinking, 8-sided high-rise building. We have an 8-sided auditorium. It'd be great to get in there with some 8-sided invite cards and put them all under the doors and say, hey, love the fact that you've joined your new flat and you're having an 8-sided experience. Why don't you extend that on a Sunday and come and join us in our 8-sided auditorium? But that's just me and how I think. That would be fun. Creativity begets creativity. One idea sparks another, doesn't it? When somebody has a good idea, it makes you think and you have a good idea. That's the very essence of creativity. Creativity is incredibly powerful because it can take us from nothing to something. And that's incredibly appealing. And I want to suggest that all the things that people do to build their life are forms of creativity. Everything you do to create your life, all of the plans and hopes that you have, all the training you go and do, all the investment in your future, all the attempts to try and do great things with jobs and all the rest of it, that is you being creative, trying to build a life. And it's woven right in there. The Bible has a lot to say about creativity. Creativity is within the very essence of who God is. God is a creative God. When you read the first sentence of the whole Bible, which I'll be reading out loud on Sunday, the 22nd of October at 2 p.m. downstairs in room one, as we commence something very creative, which is reading out the Bible out loud from end to end without stopping. Just a little plug for that there. Sign up at, you know, bcc.life, what's on. Get yourself in there and get yourself a 20-minute reading slot. You will not regret it. When I start that, I'm going to be opening with the first sentence of the Bible, which says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The verb, the action in that very first sentence of the very first verse of the very first chapter of the Bible is the word created. God is a creative God. Our God is hugely creative. And over a period of 6 days, God goes on to create absolutely everything, so that by Genesis 2, verse 1, it tells us this: so the heavens and the earth and everything in them were completed in all their vast array, it says in some translations. And the Bible is really clear that we ourselves are also part of the Lord's creation. People are created beings. Human beings have been made by God. David describes how we are made in the wonderful poetry of Psalm 139. Let me share this with you. And as I read it, listen out for all the references to being made and to creation. For it was you who created my inward parts. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I will praise you because I have been remarkably and wondrously made. Your works are wondrous, and I know this very well. My bones were not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was formed in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw me when I was formless. All my days were written in your book and planned before a single one of them began. That's at the end there. That's God the planner creating our days and putting them out before us. And I think it is so much more helpful and empowering for our lives to know that someone made us. Origin and destiny are big influences upon us. If you watch that program, Who Do You Think You Are? And those people who go on that journey of their genealogy and they go back through time, they get a bit weepy when they find out who their relatives were and what they went through, because origins matter. And equally, destiny matters. When you know you're going somewhere in God, it gives you a confidence and a peace that if all bets are off and you don't know that, everything seems so much more haphazard and random. If we think we've got no origins and no destiny, and that we're just the result of millions of random mutations over millions of years, it can actually affect your self-esteem quite a lot. There's a totally different explanation that the Bible gives, which is that we originated in God's mind, we are in his plans, and we're in his heart, and we are created for destiny and purpose. It says in Ephesians 2:10, we are God's workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared ahead of time for us to do. Now, you might imagine in a message like this, there would be a great temptation to go on a great long kind of debate about evolution versus creation. And clearly, that is a hot topic for many of us. But I'm just going to put a foundational stance there that I don't believe we arrived here by chance. I believe there was a creator God who made you and I. And he has a purpose and a destiny for each and every one of us, according to what he has put in us, which is creative, which has got ability. And actually, creativity is a key hallmark of who God is. One of the things that spills over from God into us as part of him making us is that we are creative just like he is. He is a creative God, and we are made in his image, and therefore it stands to reason that we have creativity as well. We know this, don't we? We're creative people. We can create all sorts of things. Back when I was kind of about 4 or 5, I remember probably the first event where I kind of did the thing where it sort of dawned on me afterwards that I shouldn't have done it. You know, when you're a young kid and you're kind of exploring what's right and what's naughty. And my mum and dad took me round to someone's house for a meal, I think it was. And the lady in this house was quite impressed to hear my mum say that I was quite a creative guy. And she produced a large packet of non-washable felt tips. Okay, you can see where this story's going, can't you? And so I had this large packet of felt tips, and I was told that I could just, you know, don't restrict his creativity, this woman said. My mum said, do you know what? I think it would be best if we supervise this. You know, I think he needs paper and he should sit with us and, you know, don't let this just happen. Please, you know, I really don't think he should have these felt tips and be left to his own devices. The woman said, listen, far be it from us to curtail his creativity. A top tip for new parents, if your young child is really silent for a long time in another part of the house, that's a warning sign, okay? That is a big warning sign right there. You need to go and investigate quickly. And sure enough, I did my own attempt at a Renaissance grandmaster on this woman's carpet in her back room. It wasn't quite 67.3 meters in scope, but it was pretty large. I think she actually had to replace her carpet. And at the end, she expressed disappointment to my mum and dad. My mum said, well, I did try and tell you, but you didn't want to hear. The reason I did that with the felt tips is because I'm a creative person. You and I are creative people. Many of us in the room would have done exactly the same at that age with that opportunity. And it's because we're hardwired to be creative. Isn't that right? We have creativity hardwired into us because God is a creative God. And we inherit that characteristic because we're made in his image. Creativity is an absolutely vital component of what we need in order to have dominion over the earth and in order for us to step into all the plans and purposes that God has for us. And that's why he endows us with it and gives it to us. And so we're going to unpack some of the meaning of the parable of the talents. Our reading today that Temi read for us comes from Matthew 25, 14 to 30. That reading is on our YouVersion event. You can scan that QR code up there and it takes you to the YouVersion event and you can follow through the notes and make your own comments on there just for future memory. But just as we begin to unpack the parable, let's not forget that a parable itself is a creative thing. You know, that the characters in the parables, they live in our minds in this powerful way, don't they? But actually, that's Jesus being creative with us. If you think about it, masterfully creative, actually. Some of his parables are awesome, and they teach us incredible things with figurative truth. But they are creative attempts or efforts from his divine mind to teach us something in our human mind. I've picked this parable today because I think we all feel a strong sense of needing to create something of our lives with what Jesus has given us. I really feel that that's true. And any effort we make towards building a life will be underpinned by wanting to bring something into existence that did not exist before we came along, whether that be a family, a career, an invention, a book, a way of seeing the world, a piece of art. I don't know what it might be. There's something incredibly appealing about, okay, before we came along, the world didn't have this. And then now I've been here and I've created something because God has asked me to do it, and now the world does have it. That's very appealing. You know, Thomas Edison was the inventor of the light bulb, and apparently he went through 1,000 or so iterations before he hit on the formula where the element inside, the gas inside a light bulb would glow and not burn out. That took him a long time to get to that point, but he invented it. Imagine the sense of satisfaction of being the person who invented a light bulb. That's a pretty awesome thing. That sense of creativity that God gives us is a huge potential and door opener and invitation from him to have a go at doing some great things and making the world a better place. So let's talk through this parable and see what it has to teach us about creativity and building a life, because that's what it's all about. Jesus is represented by the man who goes away on a long journey, like the master of the house. The delay represents the time we will need to wait before he comes back at the second coming. The talents in the parable represent all the resources and gifts and privileges and opportunities and finances and people, actually, that Jesus entrusts around us and to us as his disciples. And those who are faithful and use these things responsibly and well will be rewarded for their fruitfulness and their good stewardship by Jesus himself. But those who don't make good use of what Jesus has given them, however, will get a pretty strong rebuke. I mean, that's quite a strong telling off that Jesus gives at the end, isn't it? You lazy, evil servant. I really don't want Jesus to say that to me. Can I just put my hand up right now and say, Jesus, please don't say that to me. And if I'm going to get that, give me some steering now so I can avoid it. I don't want to be known as lazy and evil. That's a horrible rebuke from Jesus. It really is. What is absolutely key to the parable of the talents is that we're to create something with what we've been given by Jesus to bring about the fruitfulness that he hopes for us. And it's just not that creative to dig a hole, is it? And dig a hole and hide what we've got and put it in the hole. Well, that's not really going to earn us well done, good and faithful servant at the end, is it? If that's all we've done. So what lessons can we glean on how to create something of our lives from this parable? Now, there's a ton of stuff in here, and I had this really annoying pastor's thing during the week, where as I got into this parable, I realized there's probably a series in it, and that never helps a pastor, because I've got an embarrassment of riches. I've cut out 1,500 words already from today. So I'm going to give you headlines, and then give you some pointers on a couple of things to focus on as part of our response, you know, like our start, our step, and our stretch, which is our way that we're responding to these big ideas in this series. So let me break them up into three parts. Things that you can learn about Jesus, things you can learn from the successful servants, the ones who did the right thing, and then things you can learn from the fearful servant who kind of messes up at the end. And it's helpful if we go through those in that order. Let me just take you through them. First of all, Jesus entrusts us with his possessions. Just like the master going on the journey, Jesus says, hey, have all this stuff. Have it all. Just, I give you everything. And just so that you know, a talent was considered a huge amount of money in those days. A talent was estimated to be about 20 years' worth of wages. And so for that guy who had five, that's 100 years' worth of wages. I jumped onto the Office for National Statistics website to find out what the average salary is in the UK. And you may not know this figure, but it's 32,000 a year. That's the average salary in the UK. And so 100 years of the average salary in today's money is £3.2 million. That's a lot that Jesus has given that guy with the five, isn't it? That's a lot. So he's given a lot there. So he entrusts us with loads of stuff. Number two, Jesus made our ability. I was chatting to somebody in the break who was kind of telling me about, you know, one of Tchaikovsky's compositions. I think it was even Roy might have been saying this. But actually that kind of came from God. Can I just put that out there? You know, we didn't have that ability ourselves. We're just using that ability as God gave it to us and as he put it in us. And so Jesus and God and the Holy Spirit are the people who make our ability. Now, that should lead us to a little bit of a sense of humility, because what makes us creative and capable all came from the Lord in the first place. It doesn't kind of come from us. And so, you know, when you get people going on about their achievement and all their stuff that they've done, I'm like, yeah, but actually God gave you that in the first place. Now, in the parable, it's the master who assesses the ability. He's not the person who's responsible for putting the ability into his servants in the first place. So that's where the parable differs a little bit from reality. But Jesus does put all the abilities we have on the inside of us when he makes us. He does. Number three, Jesus assigns the talents according to individual ability. So he sees a person who's a five-talent kind of a person, he gives them five talents. He sees a person who has two, and he gives them two. And the third gets one. But so what he's saying is different people do have different abilities, but Jesus knows that, and he doesn't expect what's beyond what we're capable of. You know, he doesn't give five to the one and then get upset because he doesn't manage it. He gives one to the one. And so he's very fair. Jesus won't entrust us with things that are beyond our ability, even though it may feel like it's well beyond our ability from time to time. Sometimes, especially when we have those step-up moments, when we're trying to be creative, it can feel a little bit overwhelming, can't it? But often if Jesus is kind of behind that, we will step into it and then find that we do actually have the ability after all. Number four, Jesus does not make success a comparison sport between people. He just doesn't. So he treats each person on an individual basis according to the ability they have. And so if you've got an ability in a particular area, Jesus is going to talk to you about that at the end of time to find out how much you did with that ability. Jesus never berates or tells off a two-talent person for not being a five-talent person. You know, he doesn't tell the one-talent person off because they're a one-talent person. He tells them off because they did nothing with it, which is a slightly different thing. And that means our assessment that we get from Jesus is based on who we made us to be, not how we match up against other people. And actually, that's a real relief. You know, in this world, we're not in a competition with a whole lot of other people. We are in a competition with the blueprint that Jesus has put on the inside of us. And that makes things very, very different. You don't need to do the comparison game with anybody else at all. Only do the comparison game with the model that you think Jesus has put on the inside of you. That's actually very liberating. You can stop doing the whole keeping up with the Joneses thing and saying, well, I've got this income, but they've got that income, or I've reached this status in life, but they haven't. And all that, that's very, very unhealthy anyway. Jesus is only interested in what he has entrusted to you, not what he might have entrusted to someone else. Fifthly, Jesus awards greater and greater responsibility. Do you see that if you're faithful in the small things, suddenly you have a bit more responsibility? And that's a real truth in life, isn't it? If you do well in the tiny thing, people will notice that and go, ah, have a bigger thing. And if you do well in that, you have an even bigger thing, and so on and so on and so on, until you gradually get weaned onto larger and larger responsibilities. And that's a kingdom principle, and we see it right here in this parable. If we do well in the small, Jesus will go large on us. Have you ever been to the window at the drive-through McDonald's and you're placing an order and you hear the voice through the speaker, would you like to go large? And you have that little battle with yourself and then you go, yeah, I'll go large. That's a kingdom principle right there. You never knew that, did you? But actually, if you're faithful in the small, Jesus will go large on you. He will. Number six, Jesus shares his joy at the results of what we have created. There is a godly joy that goes around at fruitful creativity. There is absolutely no doubt in my mind at all that 99% of the world are delighted when they do a really good job from what is their ability that makes a difference, that has a real impact. Most people get an absolute buzz out of just that. That's what a lot of people live for, actually, more than being paid your salary. If you do a good job and it absolutely makes a difference, the salary is almost irrelevant. Now, it's not, because we need a living. I get that. But that's often not the motivator behind what people do for work. Let me give you a classic illustration of what that is. Anybody here watch MasterChef? Yeah, if you've seen the cooking program MasterChef, when that moment comes where that person has created a new dish and they put that dish in front of the judges and the judges lift the spoon from the special soup, you know, to their mouth and they sip it and then they go, oh. And then the contestant is like welling up with delight because they have hit the mark. They have delivered some really, really nice food. That is godly joy at creativity, an illustration of it right there. And it's really interesting to me that the master in this parable says, yeah, share in my godly joy, you know, share in my joy, share in your master's joy at what you've done with the things you've tried to create. Seventhly, that we can learn about Jesus, Jesus eventually reassigns his possessions where they will be most fruitful. And this is the sobering back end of this story, or this parable, which is that after a while, I think Jesus decides, or the master decides, okay, you one talent person that you did nothing with your one talent, actually that's going to be given to other people. And that's actually a kind of common principle that we see around us, don't we? If you see people who do investments in business, there comes a point at which they say, okay, I'm going to take my money out of this now because this just isn't working. And I'm going to put my money with some people I know are going to turn my money into a good return. We see that in the world of business quite a bit, don't we? And actually, Jesus is just being he's teaching something about good stewardship here. At some point or another, if we're not fruitful, the master's going to find another way to be fruitful, and he'll find others to do that. And that's a little scary. I don't want to be a kind of person that Jesus takes stuff off in order to give it to someone else so that they can be fruitful in a way that I wasn't being fruitful with. That's a little scary. Here's some things briefly to learn from the successful servants. We've learned a few things from Jesus. What about the successful servants? Well, firstly, the two successful servants did not waste any time at all getting on with what they've been asked to do. It tells us that the five-talent guy and also the two-talent guy immediately get on with getting their talent to work. So there's no wasting time. And I think that really speaks to some of us today where we just sit in this space of, oh, one day I'll get around to using my talent. One day I'll do something about that. And we're sitting there with lots of intentions, but we're not actually matching that with some immediately action. Action is really helpful because action gives you data back way, way more than just thoughts do when you're deciding upon a creative venture. These guys got on immediately with it. There was no procrastination. There was not sitting around chatting about it. There was not telling all of the friendship network. They just had a go, and they started finding ways to put what they'd been given to work. Which leads me nicely into the second thing that we can learn from the successful guys, the two-talent guy and the five-talent guy, that work is a mandatory requirement for talents to become effective. How many of us in the room know that person who is super talented in a particular area, but we sense they just don't do any work with it? And it's quite frustrating, isn't it? You know, they pick up a guitar one day and you never knew that they could play the guitar, and they're stunningly good at the guitar, and your jaw hits the deck. And then you kind of like, so what have you done with that? And it's like, oh, I'll just do it now and then. And you're thinking, what? You're so talented. Don't be one of those people. I want to suggest to us that the people who are kind of averagely talented, maybe those two talent people in life, they are going to get further through hard work than the five talent people, perhaps, who don't do anything with what they've been given. Hard work is really, really important. It's kind of like an adjunct or connected quality with creativity. Creativity is great, but you need hard work to give it legs, for it to actually to hit the streets and to make a difference. Hard work will always need to accompany talent if we want to create something of any substance in life. I have found this to be true over and over again. I can have all the great ideas in the world and all the creativity of all the inventors in the world, but it's not going to count for anything unless I put some hard work behind it. And that what we notice from two-talent guy and five-talent guy is they put some work in straight away. Thirdly, we are most likely to reproduce what has been put into us. That's another lesson of these successful servants. And so what we see is the five-talent person goes ahead and reproduces after their kind another five talents. The two-talent person goes ahead and produces another two talents. And what that tells me is that there's a lesson there, which is that what has been assigned to us is likely to have a bearing on what we're going to create. So in plain terms, if God has put great art on the inside of you, like he clearly did with Paolo Veronese there in the 1560s, then great art is likely to be the thing that emerges. But that also means that if God didn't put certain things inside you, don't strive to try and make them appear out of a kind of envy of another person's ability. Don't be doing that. Try and work out what it is that God has got assigned to you and go after that. It can take a while to learn what those things are. You know, I kind of envy the child who said, you know, in the primary school at six, oh, I'd like to be a fireman, and they now are a fireman. That was never very clear to me what I wanted to be when I was six. In fact, I only found myself in Bible college when I was 38. So for those of you guys that are kind of not quite sure what you want to do yet with life, keep on trying, keep on being diligent, keep on putting those creative efforts out there, and one day God will show you and he'll open a door. But it's not gonna happen with you sitting thinking creatively about it. Take some action to get some data back in order to progress. Number four, this is just in a bunch of lessons that we can pick up from the successful servants. The successful servants are rightly proud of their results. I love how both the successful servants say to the master, "See, see, look what I've done. See what I've made. See what I've created. I've created another five or another two." Our kids come and do this, don't they? Those of you who have kids, you get a tug on the sleeve, don't you? "Mummy, daddy, come and see. Come and see what I've made." And like, there was one time when, you know, George, Simon and Adam were 6, 4 and 2, and there was a sequence of "come and see." And sometimes that's like, okay, yeah, yay, I'll come and see. And actually you've got to put that effort in because that's so validating for your kids to have that parental pleasure. Even when you're tired, that parental pleasure over what they've created is so important for our children's development. And actually, the same is true for us as children of God. And in this parable, we see those servants say, hey, to the master, hey, see what I've done. The successful servants are rightly proud of their results, and they want Jesus to see, or they want the master to see. And I think we have a right, when we've done something great, to show it to Jesus and to be pleased with what we've done. Let's just switch in the final moments just to some lessons very quickly from the fearful servant. Thank you so much for your attention. I'm conscious I've packed a lot in today, and I hope it's you're still with me. First of all, from the fearful servant, criticism doesn't create anything. I think there's a kind of law in life, a kind of an 80-20 law, that if you're trying to build something, it needs to be 80% creative effort and trying to keep the criticisms to 20%. You can't build something purely on criticism. You just can't. Being a critical person or having a habit of criticism is useful in certain areas, and it's helpful to be objective and to go, well, that's not working, or to receive feedback. But the lion's share of building your life comes from creativity and having a go and putting something out there and not being afraid to realize that, okay, I looked a fool for you, God, but I had a go. I tried. Don't not try just because you think you're, because you're fearful of criticism. Some of us really struggle with the inner critic, don't we? Or the critics that we've had in our family. Or the critics that kind of come up, maybe the enemy says things to us. Oh, you can't ever do that. Who are you to stand up and speak to people? Who are you to run a business? Who are you to go and aim to get a degree? Don't you know your family background? And you have to kind of suppress that criticism, because that criticism will not help you build a life. It will not help you with your creativity. This fearful servant brings a very unfair criticism to the master, because the master has sown some fantastic things into his servants. It's not correct to say that he's a harsh man reaping where he hasn't sown. No, he's given them lots and lots of investment and input. Number two, fear snuffs out creativity. I think if you're fearful, it's really hard to be creative. Really hard. I can think of any number of different interviews I've seen on TV and on YouTube where an artist or a musician has had a dry period where they couldn't create because they had a sort of a fear that they were navigating. It says in this parable that the guy was afraid. We're not entirely sure why he's afraid, because the story he says about the master isn't accurate. Maybe he's projected onto the master, and actually he's fearful of his own limitation. And I think all of us battle with that. Fear dampens lots of things down, but especially our willingness to be creative and throw ourselves into a new venture. And lastly, hiding our talent in the ground, in a hole in the ground, serves nobody. In this room and online, my guess is there's a huge number of awesome talents. Do not be hiding your talent in the ground. Come on. Do we have another Paolo Veronese in here that wants to spend a year and 2 months creating one piece of art for the glory of God? Come on. What kind of talent have we got in this room and in our church? I think it's phenomenal. You know those conversations you have with people and you find out, you do what? You're good at this? Come on, let's bring some of our talents to the glory of God. Let's use what we're good at to build the kingdom. Let's go that distance. I'm going to ask the worship team just to return. Thank you so much, Kevin. Just come and start to play. Burying the talent in the ground is the worst thing that guy could have done with the stewardship of his ability. Because its potential just sits there languishing, doesn't it? Let me suggest briefly to you some ways we might want to respond. The start could be, let's confront some excuses. Are you the kind of person that makes excuses for things? Do a little analysis of the number of excuses you've made in the last month or so, and why. What are your excuses? Because often behind our excuses lies a journey into the fearful servant. And we would do well to try and understand the anatomy of our excuses and what are they trying to do? What are they trying to get us out of? The start would be, have a look at some of our excuses. The next bit, the step would be, try something brand new. Something I really appreciate about Roy as an elder is, even at 81, he is going to be doing some new ministries with us. He's doing some new things with his life. So this isn't about age or thinking that you've got all of your life ahead of you to try some new things. You can try some new things at any age. When's the last time you did something absolutely brand new that you've never ever done before? I'll just put it to you. It's a challenge. And then the last thing I want to suggest to us all today is, what is the one thing on the inside of you, the one thing on the inside of you that you could take right down to the very end of its full potential? That you could absolutely rinse out every single last molecule in your body that God put there for that purpose. What is the one thing that you're the best at? Absolutely the best at, and you know you're good at it. What is that one thing, and how far could you take that for maximum impact for the glory of God? Could you get to the end of time with that one area and hear Jesus say, do you know what? You absolutely maxed out on that, even more than I think you would have done. Well done, good and faithful servant. You really, really used that ability that I put on the inside of you. You really created with that. Well done. What is that one thing for you? You probably might have an inkling as to what it is already. And I'd love to encourage you to keep on fueling that fire. Keep going with that. It's vital. BCC, let's all stand and we're going to worship. Thank you, Kevin. Thank you, team.